Good afternoon. You are tuned in to a Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 9th of February, the year 2016. Jeff Ryan will be here today. We'll be learning about the Great Backyard Bird Count with guests Brenda Wright and Doug Jones. We'll get a preview of this Thursday's Tiny Post Office Concert featuring Emmett Williams and Sitka and Goldwing from Juno. We'll also get the details about this Wednesday night's Mud Rooms event. We'll talk to members of the Zach Gordon Youth Center's winning team in the recent district-wide Battle of the Books competition. That Writer's Almanac, Murnote, Music and More today on a Juno Afternoon. Tonight at 4, tune in to KTVO News for live coverage from NPR about Tuesday night in the New Hampshire primary. With a forecast for tonight, rain later on with low temperatures 36 to 41 degrees. Wednesday, chance of rain in the morning, then rain in the afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's Minister of Indigenous Affairs was in Winnipeg this week to meet with the families of murdered and missing Aboriginal women. It's part of a cross-country tour she's making before launching a full national investigation. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, the minister noted these meetings were different.
Indigenous Affairs Minister Carolyn Bennett says these meetings are important to help set the parameters for the inquiry, which is expected to get underway this summer. Bennett described Winnipeg as ground zero in the growing awareness that Canadians have for the struggle and plight of Aboriginal women in Canada. But she says in Winnipeg, unlike other cities she's toured, there seems to be more anger.
People are concerned about the police, they're concerned about government, and frankly they were quite skeptical as to whether an inquiry will help at all.
Winnipeg is Bennett's 11th stop on her pre-inquiry tour. Some describe the meeting as tense, especially from people who attended and who carried a lot of pain for years. Thelma Favelle, whose niece Tina Fontaine was murdered in 2014 and whose death reignited calls for an inquiry, says money being spent on a national inquiry would be better spent on creating safe havens for young Aboriginal people.
This thing will never bring Tina back, but if it's going to help another child, then her death is not for nothing.
Carolyn Bennett admits it will be a challenge to determine the mandate and scope of a national inquiry. She says it must deal with key issues, but also address the concerns of victims' families. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Yupik and Inupiaq people discuss the word Eskimo, this after Alaska Airlines recently unveiled its new look. Alaska Native people criticized the company's campaign, which prompted the airline's chief executive to apologize. Charles Enoch has more.
Alaska Airlines unveiled their new airplane and website designs late last month. Both prominently feature the familiar face of a smiling Alaska Native elder. The website also included the phrase "Meet our Eskimo," which was quickly changed to "Meet the Eskimo." But does the change go far enough?
I would rather be called Inupiaq, because that's what I am, and my children are Yupik.
That was Blossom Twitchell from Kotzebue.
I want them to be able to connect to their culture, and people won't group us in as little people that live in igloos, give little Eskimo kisses all the time. We are so much more than that.
No one seems to have a definitive answer on where the word Eskimo came from. An article by University of Alaska Fairbanks linguist Lawrence Kaplan said the word meaning eater of raw meat might have been given to the Inupiaq people by Western explorers. The article also says the Canadian version of the word could have come from an Ojibwa word meaning knitter of snowshoes. The word isn't used much in Canada as it's considered offensive by many Inuit in the country, but Alaska Natives say they have been using the word for a while. Nils Alexi is a Yupik elder from Bethel.
In my first memories, we used Eskimo when referring to ourselves or each other. Then, along the way, we started using the word Yupik to describe ourselves.
Alexi is like many Yupiks interviewed for this story that are accustomed to the term and have no firm position about whether it's appropriate or not. Other Yupik elders, however, don't like the term. Dr. Teresa John is an associate professor for Indigenous Studies at UAF.
If we stop using the names other people give us, they will understand. Our ancestors were proud to be Yupik and were strengthened by their way of life. They wanted us, their descendants, to keep our tradition alive.
The airline ultimately changed their website greeting, completely removing the word Eskimo, and stated they are looking forward to working together with the Alaska Native community to ensure their actions reflect their respect for all Alaska Natives and Alaskans alike. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at NARF.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to KTUO and KRNN on Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host for today. First guests in the studio are Brenda Wright and Doug Jones. They're here to talk about Audubon, whales, and birds. Thanks for coming down the station today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
So you're talking about the annual meeting for the Audubon Society.
Yes, we're having our general public meeting the second Thursday of every month, October through April, and it's this week, and Doug is our guest performer. He's going to talk about whales, humpback whales, and killer whales.
Doug, tell me something about whales that most people don't know.
Humpback whales and killer whales are the two most common whales we have in Juneau, and I think it's an interesting story. There was a gentleman named Chuck Chiraz who was a science teacher here at the high school years ago, and during the summer he had a boat and would take students and go out to Glacier Bay to study humpback whales, and he discovered that the bottom of the tail is like a fingerprint. It's unique, one whale to the next. And about the same time he was doing that, this was in the 70s, there was a gentleman in Hawaii named Jim Darling who was doing the same thing. Before the days of the internet, they heard about each other. And in 1979, Jim Darling flew from Hawaii to Juneau. The two of them sat down in a bar on South Franklin and started comparing photographs. And the third or fourth photograph they turned over was a match. And that was the first clue we had that our whales here in Alaska swim all the way to Hawaii and back.
Didn't they first talk about bubble feeding? Bubble net feeding,
yes. It's a unique behavior, and it's a learned behavior. And there's a quote in one of the books, a measure of intelligence is being able to modify the behavior of others to your own advantage. And this is an example in humpback whales where they're doing exactly that. A fun fact, I think, that I usually use in my show is that a herring, which is one of the primary feed for the humpback whale, can swim 4.1 meters a second. A humpback whale can only swim 3.8. So in a flat-out race, the herring's going to win every time. So the humpback whale has to figure out a way then to corral those herring and feed on them. And bubble net feeding is just that. One of the whales dives down deep, starts exhaling and spiraling back up to the surface. And that creates this column of bubbles that comes up. The bait fish see that as a barrier, spook into a tighter ball in the center. Another whale will go down and trumpet, spook them higher up, and then they all come up through that bait ball at the surface and fill their mouths. That's a unique behavior on this coast. And there are other unique behaviors in different populations of humpback whales, but it's a fun one to watch here during the summers.
So during the annual meeting, or the regular meeting, you're going to be talking about humpback whales, but also about killer whales.
Also about killer whales. Killer whale is known as the apex predator in the ocean, and I tell a story in my talk that leaves absolutely no question about that. A killer whale and a great white shark going head-to-head. They are incredible predators. Their brains are about 5 times larger than our brains. When they examine them under a microscope, they have the same complex microstructures we do, so they're probably very, very intelligent. And in my show, I play sounds, echolocation, because like a bat, they use echolocation to detect prey in the water. And they have dialects. They communicate underwater using dialects. And I play the dialects for the 3 main types of killer whales that we've got here in Southeast British Columbia and the Puget Sound area.
I can tell people are just getting excited about the presentation during the annual regular meeting.
These are fun animals, and they're fun to talk about.
And Doug is an excellent photographer. You'll really, really enjoy his photos.
Brenda, can you remind me when the regular meeting
is? It's going to be 7 p.m. this Thursday, UAS Recreation Center, room 116.
And do you have to be a member of Audubon to go?
No, it's free and open to the public. And if you've never heard Doug speak or seen any of his videos or photos, you really should come and enjoy them.
He's so good, even Disney used him. How many Audubon members are there in Juneau?
We have a little bit over 200 members here in Juneau, but because of our location, we also are considered the Southeast chapter. And so there's over 350 total.
What kind of activities do you organize?
We like to do spring bird walks during migration. We have our public programs out every second Thursday of the month, October through April. And in the summertime, we do things that we call Saturday Wild, like take a walk up above the tram for birds, mushrooms, geology, low tides, whatever comes up.
The Great Backyard Count.
Yes, the Great Backyard Bird Count.
What's so great about it?
It's great because it's not just a backyard. It is anywhere you see a bird. Look out the window, go out to the beach, into the woods, go skiing. No matter where you see a bird, if you take the time and check and look for at least 15 minutes, count how many birds and different species there are, then you can go right to birdcount.org online and give your data online.
That's very easy.
It's very easy, and it's free. You may, if you don't already have a membership to Cornell or the Great Backyard Bird Count, you just sign up. That's free. And then after you put your data in, you can pick any species in the world and check and see how many people have seen it and where, all around the world. They update the maps as you watch.
What kind of bird is the most pervasive here in Southeast?
Oh, you know, in the wintertime here, it's a kind of a toss-up between our glaucous wing gulls and mallards. But in the summertime, it's a little bit different mix because a lot of the birds that come here in the winter to enjoy our open tidal areas for food go someplace else to nest. So it's a changing view out there. This particular Great Backyard Bird Count is based on trying to find out more about winter birds in their normal habitats.
What was the thing that surprised you most? Although you've been doing this for a number of years, really nothing has surprised you.
Oh, everything surprises me. There's things that, especially this winter, with this warm weather, we've been seeing species here that we almost never see in winter. Of course, we had all the common murres here during the big extravaganza during November and December at Auk Bay, but they're still around. The food that they would normally eat out in the open ocean near the edge of the continental shelf, there just isn't any. The water's too warm. And we're seeing birds that are unusual for winter here, like swans and red-breasted sapsuckers. And it's really unusual. It's amazing to see what's out there that isn't normally here in our winters.
So for those people whose eyes glazed over while you were discussing how exactly they take part.
Okay, all you have to do is go outside or go stand by your feeder. Check and look at the birds. Try not to count any bird twice. If you're looking at a feeder, don't count that same chickadee that comes 15 times. Just count it once. Go to birdcount.org online and put your data in.
Is there any meeting place after the count?
No, not in particular. This is something that everybody can do on their own. It's 4 days. It starts this Friday, the 12th, and goes through Monday, the 15th, anytime, any place, all day and night. You can count birds. If you happen to have an owl living next to your home, please put that in. That's really good information for us. And you can count more than once. If you go to the beach and then you stay by your bird feeder, it's perfectly okay to do two different lists for one day.
Great Backyard Bird Count.
Great Backyard Bird Count.
Anything you'd like to end up here and ask?
No, but please do join us. It's always more fun to have more people out there looking.
And remind us when that regular meeting is again.
Our meeting is this Thursday, 7 p.m., UAS Recreation Center at room 116.
And Doug, thanks for coming by and sharing your whale stories.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's Adela Marley Booker, Bob Marley's mother, singing along with Taj Mahal. It's 17 minutes past the hour now, and you're tuned to KTOR News in Juneau and KRNN FM in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Jeff Rand, I'm your host. Our next guest is Christy Nami Erickson, here to talk about the Kindred Post Tiny Post Office concert this weekend. Christy, thank you very much for coming down the station.
Jeff, always a pleasure to see you.
So, tell me about Kindred Post.
Well, Kindred Post, we're a post office and a gift shop and a community gathering space down on Franklin across from the clock. So part of what we do is not only, you know, having mail services and not only trying to showcase artists, but to do interactive things with the community that kind of lift up the creative works that are going on in our town. And one thing that we've been doing for a while now is the Tiny Post Office Concert Series. So we're hosting our seventh concert in the series this week on Thursday with the theme of Valentine Folk.
You certainly keep busy there.
We try to.
You've got the poetry going on.
Mm-hmm. We've got poetry going on. We've done book launches there. We've, you know, got a first Friday party every first of the month or first week of the month. We're probably going to start creative workshops here soon, too. So
tell me where it's located again, please.
Yeah, 145 South Franklin on Franklin Street across from the clock.
And this Thursday, you've got a concert going on with Southeast folk musicians Emmett Williams and Goldwing.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about Emmett Williams, please?
Yeah, Emmett Williams, so he emailed me last fall. He's a transplant from somewhere in the lower 48 who just moved to Sitka, and he had heard about Kindred Post or heard about me and reached out to see if maybe there'd be any type of performing opportunities, especially small kind of gigs, intimate gigs here in Juneau. He said he has some work that he can do up here and kind of pop in sometime. And of course, our Tiny Post Office concerts were an excellent fit for him, but I wanted to kind of wait until we had another good set that would pair well. I'm trying to kind of create a little bit of themes with each of the concerts. And so when Dan Kirkwood, local musician in town, suggested doing another concert, he was actually our very first concert last summer, I think it was. I readily welcomed him back. His band Goldwing is just really a talented group, and they sound wonderful in the post office. And I thought, oh, you know, he's got kind of this folksy alternative rock sound to him. And from what I heard from Emmett Williams' videos and kind of sound clips, I thought that they would pair really nicely together. and kind of bring, you know, different types of energies, but kind of put together a solid, cohesive show.
What time does it all start?
So the show starts at 7 o'clock, but we open the doors at 6:30. From 6 to 6:30, we close the shop and we move everything out to the side. Some people who've never been to our concerts are like, how do you have a concert in that little place? But we spend a half hour transforming the shop into an empty-ish space, and then we pull a bunch of chairs down and we open the doors at 6:30. So we strongly encourage people to come earlier, near the 6:30 range instead of the 7 after 7 Juno time kind of range, if you want to score a good seat. It has filled up almost every single time to standing room only.
Tell me a little bit more about Dan Kirkwood.
Yeah, well, Dan Kirkwood, you know, was first introduced to me as, quote, Dreamy Dan by a host of girls I was hanging out with. He's just this real charming young gentleman here in town who's just a talented musician and songwriter. And he's put together a band called Goldwing. Shoot, I don't have all their names off the top of my head now. But they've been performing together for maybe almost a year now, at least half a year, almost a year. And like I said, they were our very first Tidy Post Office concert debut back in the summer.
Members of the band are Clay Good, Dan DeSluber, Ben Higdon, and Dan Kirkwood.
There you go. I knew you'd have the list.
Excellent. You know anything with the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're all just really wonderful guys. They know how to make the most out of any space. They sent me a video, YouTube video of them playing one of their songs on a boat. So Dan kind of joked that they only play in small spaces, perhaps. So they know how to adapt to a space and make the most of it, be flexible, and have a great time.
Well, I got you here. Tell me what's coming up in the poetry world.
In the poetry world, Wishkanadei has an open mic coming up, not this week, but the week after that. It's Friday. Let me look at the dates here. Is that the 18th, 19th? Friday, February 19th at Gonzo in Ok Bay. And that's part of our three-month rotations now where we do an open mic, a poetry slam, and then a writing workshop. Just last month, we did the writing workshop at Kindred Post, and we had a good group, about a dozen people, going through some different writing exercises, practicing a little bit of performance stuff, learning how to perform in front of each other and give some feedback. And we're hoping to see some of those faces again, maybe for the first time at an open mic this month.
Mr. Naomi Erickson, anything you'd like to know and forgotten to ask?
No, that's all. I appreciate you taking the time. I appreciate listeners tuning in to hear what's going on in our community. And if you've never been to Kindred Post or you've never been to one of our concerts, I strongly encourage you to stop by Thursday. It's a no-cost, donations-only event, so it doesn't hurt anything just to peek your head through and have a listen to some of our amazing Juno talent.
All right, thanks for coming by. Doors open about 6:30 or so, and get there early to make sure you get a seat.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Christy, for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff.
I'm going to play a little bit of the music of Goldwing.
Boy, in turns of phrases, I walk the straight line.
Dan Kirkwood recorded live in the 360 studio downstairs here at KTOO. Our next guests are Melissa Griffiths and Steve Sewing here to talk about Mudrooms, which is going on tomorrow night. It's tonight, isn't it?
It's tonight. Yep. Yeah, just a couple hours.
Y'all ready?
I'm ready. Thanks for having us here, Jeff.
What do you have to do to get ready?
What do we have to do to get ready? Well, we've got to make sure that our hosts have their notes of who's speaking tonight, who the charity we're going to be donating to. This is going to be our first event of this season that we're donating the proceeds to Meals on Wheels. So making sure that all the storytellers are going to be showing up, making sure someone's picking up the cookies and refreshments, and getting down to Northern Lights Church at 6 o'clock this evening for a 7 o'clock show.
A lot of stuff going on. Just to put together a concert that you think is pretty easy to do, and then when you try to do it yourself, you realize how much work there is.
Yeah, every time you add an extra person, I think anything gets complicated. But we've got a well put together team, and we've got a good model that we've been working with for the last 4.5 years. And we've got storytellers that are good about being fairly timely and showing up to commitments that they've made, and musicians as well. So, yeah, it's a well run program.
And you get your Mardi Gras beads on.
I do. Happy Fat Tuesday, everyone.
So Steve's preparations are, as one of the storyboard members, one of the people who organize Mudrooms, although he's been a speaker a couple of times as well. And I've got a different story of preparation today, because I'm going to be speaking for the first time. And I'm a little bit terrified. For some reason, people think that I'm a public speaker, and I am not. I do best when it's like me putting words on paper that people will read very far away.
Melissa, someone that I identified not too long ago as someone that would like to get up in front of a Mudrooms audience, because she is known for her storytelling in print. And I think a lot of people in the community have been exposed to her storytelling and really appreciate it. But like Melissa said, there's assumptions that she likes telling her own story in a public place. And I think that's what's one of the great things about Mudrooms is if you're like Melissa and you don't like public speaking, it definitely gives you an opportunity in a really friendly atmosphere that's open and understanding. And people are definitely come with open hearts and ready to listen.
Seven tellers, $7, 7 minutes.
That's correct. We've got 7 storytellers tonight, and the topic this evening, or the theme, is romantic entanglements. And around the dinner table at our house for the last couple weeks, my 7-year-old keeps on asking about what the topic is, because he's attended a couple Mudrooms. And every time we say romantic entanglements, he says, "Ooh, that sounds like a good one. I want to go." But unfortunately, or fortunately, he has something else tonight. But that's one of the things that I've been asked a couple times is, you know, what are the audience members like? And really, it's anybody. We definitely encourage younger storytellers if they've got a story to tell that ties in with the theme that we have for that event. But we definitely encourage them to show up as well. You know, some of the parents might be concerned about the content. I would say it ranges from G to PG-13. But we have been seeing a lot more younger people in the audience, and we definitely appreciate that because they make connections as well to these stories.
Melissa, we're talking with Steve about getting ready for tonight's presentation. Mm-hmm. What do you have to do to get ready?
So the first thing I did was I wrote it like I would a story, only about myself instead of about somebody else. And I guess I have told a couple of my own stories before when I was working at the Juno Empire, but this one is very personal. So that's hard. And then I met with Tom Cosgrove, who gave me some pointers on my presentation and maybe adjusting a couple things to make it not confusing. Because when you're talking about entanglements, it can get confusing. And then I made the adjustments, and what I've been doing for, like, the past 24 hours is, so I took what I had typed, and then I handwrote it, because I thought maybe that would help me remember it better, and then I, like, took what I had handwritten, and then I handwrote, like, an outline, and then I wrote it again on note cards, on one side, like, full text, and on the other side, I wrote just, like, keywords. And then I was trying to read it from that or do it from the keywords. And then I tried doing it without, and I recorded myself, and then I was listening to that over and over again. And maybe that's crazy, or maybe that's the right way to do it, but I still don't know if I'm prepared.
We have a good judge in the studio. Is she crazy?
I don't know. We'll find out tonight. I think that she brought up two good points, is that mudrooms, you know, if you volunteered to tell a story, we don't leave you out there on your own. We definitely give you some resources and kind of sounding boards. And Tom Cosgrove is one of the storyboard members that's a fantastic storyteller and well-known for his stories and is definitely committed to stories and how they're told, and is more than willing to help people through their stories. But she also keyed in on something else that I think is kind of the root of mudrooms, and that's personal stories. Anytime you get in front of a group or with friends and tell something that's personal, it leaves you the real possibility of making some firm connections, and I think that's why we've been so successful and continue to be with the mudrooms events.
Seems like a lot of times the stories that are being told are stories that they've told themselves dozens of times when they're around dinner parties or the dinner table.
Yes, 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 I think so. And I think, you know, that the forum definitely brings out some things that might not have been brought out before.
Melissa, you mentioned writing for the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
What is kind of the difference between writing for a speech and writing for a newspaper?
Well, so that assumes that I am going to do a different thing or do a better job on one or the other. But so writing for the newspaper, most of the time I was writing other people's stories. So I went through the process, like kind of like what is going on right now, interviewing somebody and them responding. Only then I would type it all up and kind of package it into an organized manner and tell a story and usually try to include a few puns. I like puns. And this time, it's a lot more conversational, and a name has been changed, which in newspaper writing, you're usually, you know, giving all the facts. And I don't know. I don't think it would be news, what I am talking about, but maybe gossip column fodder. So if this is appealing to all of you, gossip and romantic entanglement.
I'm in.
Tonight's the night.
Romantic entanglements. Who's telling stories tonight?
Tonight our storytellers are India Busby, Stephanie Ashley, Ildi Nyland, Eric Orvesky, Greg Channey, Brian O'Sullivan, and of course Melissa Griffiths. And real special treat tonight, the Najuzu Marimbas are going to be our musical act tonight, and it's a beautiful day here in Juneau. Feels like springtime, but this group usually brings the heat to the event and the excitement, so I'm real excited to see them. They've been playing mudrooms a couple of times, so I'm excited to have them in the house tonight and being our musical accompaniment.
They're always really good.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, I'll third that. That's excellent there. Melissa Griffiths and Steve Suing. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Like I said, this event, $7 is the suggested donation, and all the proceeds are going to Meals on Wheels for the next four shows. Last event, we, thanks to everyone attending the event, were able to forward on $2,500 to the Southeast Food Bank. And again, the $7 is a suggested donation. I think last time, because of the testimony of the worker there at the food bank and him talking about what the food bank does, I definitely saw some people get up and give some additional donations. So if you give us $10 or $15 to pass along to Meals on Wheels, we're not going to turn it away. But $7 cash donation at the door is the recommended donation for tonight's event.
And it's all recorded and played back on the fourth Thursday at 7 o'clock of each month.
That's right. KTO has been a great partner, so if you missed the show, I know a lot of folks that probably benefit from Meals on Wheels. Probably you're familiar with Mudrooms, and maybe they've never been to an event before because they've heard it on KTO. So it's not uncommon for some of our fans to have never been to an event but have heard it on KTO. So that's another special part about the event.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
My recommendation is to show up a little early if you want to get a seat, because these events are packed. Last time, I luckily got a rocking chair that I think most people didn't think they were supposed to sit in. Maybe I wasn't supposed to.
You didn't get kicked out, so.
No.
You
very
can have the rocking chair
people.
Tonight, too.
All right, Melissa and Steve, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
The Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 9th of February, 2016. 1964, on this day, the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show for the first time, teenage girls screaming in the audience. 73 million people watched For Home. It was a record for American television at the time. It was on this day, 1870, the National Weather Service was established. At first it was called the Weather Bureau. It was part of the War Department. Then, 20 years later, it came under the Department of Agriculture, then to the Commerce Department in 1940. These days, the National Weather Service is based out of Silver Spring, Maryland. It's the birthday of Alice Walker, born in Eatonton, Georgia, 1944, the youngest of eight children, daughter of poor sharecroppers, who graduated first in her high school class, won a scholarship to Spelman College in Atlanta, transferred to Sarah Lawrence, and met Langston Hughes, who became an early champion of her writing. Began to publish poetry in the late 1960s, and it was with her third novel, The Color Purple, in 1982, that she reached a much larger audience. It won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award in that year. And it's the birthday of the playwright and novelist Brendan Behan, born Dublin, 1923. His father took part in the Irish Rebellion of the early 20s. The father was in a British prison when the boy was born. By the time he was 16, Brendan Behan was being sent on missions to bomb British targets. He was thrown in jail for carrying a suitcase full of homemade explosives through the streets of Liverpool. And while in prison, he began to write. He wrote his first play, The Quare Fellow, and then the novel Borstal Boy and The Hostage, in which he wrote, "Never throw stones at your mother. You'll be sorry for it when she's dead. Never throw stones at your mother. Throw bricks at your father instead." Here's a poem by Baron Wormser, A Quiet Life. What a person desires in life is a properly boiled egg. This isn't as easy as it seems. There must be gas and a stove. The gas requires pipelines, mastodon drills, banks that dispense the lozenge of capital. There must be a pot, the product of mines and furnaces and factories, of dim early mornings and night owl shifts, of women in kerchiefs and men with sweat-soaked hair. Then water, the stuff of clouds and skies, and God knows what causes it to happen. There seems always too much or too little of it, and more pipelines, meters, pumping stations, towers, tanks, and salt, a miracle of the first order, the ace in any argument for God. Only God could have imagined from nothingness the pang of salt. Political peace, too, it should be quiet when one eats an egg. No political hoodlums knocking down doors, no lieutenants who are ticked off at their scheming girlfriends and take it out on you, no dictators posing as tribunes. It should be quiet, so quiet you can hear the chicken, a creature usually mocked as a type of fool, a cluck chained to the chore of her body. Listen, she's there, pecking at a bit of grain that came from nowhere. A Quiet Life, a poem by Baron Wormser, from Scattered Chapters, published by Saraband Books, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays, noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/diamondpark. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
It's about 45 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a junior afternoon. On the phone with me now is Jo Dahl, who's the lead teacher at the Johnson Youth Center. She's got a bunch of award-winning students out there. Jo, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
We're happy to be here.
So first, tell me what the Johnson Youth Center is, please.
The Johnson Youth Center is a state-run facility for teenagers who have been in trouble with the law, and they come to my classroom for a couple of years. Most of them are here for a couple of years, and we finish up high school while they're here.
What do you do as lead teacher?
All the administrivia. I do the budget and the grants and take care of testing and work with the students that are here for a long period of time. We have another teacher, Mr. Rick Currier, who's in the detention classroom, which is a very short-term classroom. And we have two teaching assistants.
How many youth are guests at the facility?
How many guests do we have? Right now we have 15 or 16. There's one in transition coming our way. So we have 16 students and we have 20 beds on the long-term side. On the short-term side, there's 8 beds.
And you've got a bunch of award winners there as far as the Battle of the Books is concerned. You want to talk to me about that, please?
Sure. We do have some. We won district this year. It was a real nail-biter. And we this is the 12th year that the JYC students have participated in the Battle of the Books. And for 7 years, we have been able to take the crown for district winners. And so this year, we will be competing in the state battle on February 22nd. Since all of that competition happens on the phone, we are able to participate.
Tell me about the Battle of the Books in general.
The Battle of the Books is kind of a uniquely Alaskan phenomena that's organized by the Alaska Librarians Association. At the high school level, the students read 12 specific books, and then we battle with questions. And in the questions are always, in which book does this or that happen? So the answers are always the title and author of the book. And we practice with practice questions. So the boys read all the books. I have an all-boy classroom, by the way. And they read the books many, many times. Right now, I think most of them are working on round 3 or 4 for most of the books they've read 3 or 4 times, because they have to really master the books, because there's no... the way the questions are worded, there could sometimes be two. They have to decipher which book it's from.
And this is the 12th year you've done this, and the 7th year to win district.
Correct. Yes.
Hey, still there?
The some people are under the delusion that these boys have a lot of time to read, just sit around and read books, but that is far from the truth. Unlike, they have more scheduled, structured time than the typical teenager. They hit the floor about 6:30 in the morning, get dressed, clean their room, do chores, clean up the cottage where they live, and do some treatment work where they think and write and reflect on things, do some homework, come to breakfast. Some of them are pulled out to do dishes for 30 or 40 people. Then they come to class, pardon me, about 9. And after the school day's over, then they also, many of them also participate in a culinary arts program that takes anywhere from 12 to 18 hours per week. That's in addition to their regular school time. They have treatment groups, and they have a lot of individual counseling and meetings between their treatment team and our on-site family clinician and that sort of thing. So they're very busy and very structured.
All right, I'm talking with Jo Dahl at the Johnson Youth Center. Jo, you want to introduce the members of the team, please?
Yes, I'd like to. We're not going to use real names, but we're going to use their duties here on the team. Our speaker is here, and his job is to – I'll let him tell you what the job is.
My job is pretty much to speak to the administrators who are recording the answers about what we have agreed upon, which is the answer.
Yeah, which answer? And he has to get the title and the author nailed.
All in one sentence, too.
Okay. And I have this lad who does the recording for the team.
say hello?
Hello.
And what is your job?
My job is to write down the keywords to the title of the book and the last name of the author, and I have to make sure that it is correct in order for the proctor to be able to recognize the handwriting and recognize mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. words are spelt right, so she doesn't get confused.
Right. So the way it works is so that there's a proctor in the room with us, and they have to say what's written down on the page, even if at the last second they've decided they were wrong and they had a different book in their mind. So the recorder's job is to write really fast but legibly. And then I have my third team member here is called the thinker. He helps keep us on track when those other two lads are doing things. So say hello.
Hi. my job on the team is to really back up my other team members. I am, like I said, a thinker. I back up like questions. I think about it a little bit more deeply. I've been through the books, I would say, more than my other team members. I started the battle team before, so I started my books earlier. So I'm usually there to back up if, you know, I hear something's wrong, I'll be able to call it out and mm-hmm. change it before it's too late.
Mm-hmm. Were you nervous at the competition?
A little bit towards the end, but yeah, we were. I would say we're all pretty nervous, actually.
Yeah, we won by one question.
Yeah, by one question. And we competed against one team from JD High and two teams from Thunder Mountain. And and one of the things that happens in the Battle of the Book is if you think you can find the answer in the book, you can do what's called a challenge. The moderator may say book A is the right answer, but you gave the answer of book B. So we had to wait for 2 minutes while Thunder Mountain looked up and did a challenge against their answer for the very last question. If they had won that question, we would have lost the Battle of the Books, but they didn't come up with the page number at that point. Close the door, please. And so it was a nail-biter there, to say the least.
Even though I assured them that they ain't going to get it, that was one of my favorite books. I read that a lot. They ain't going to get it.
What do you think? I'd like to talk to the team members now. What do you think you learned from this experience?
Always keep fighting till the end. That's something I learned. even if you're down, you know, just finish out strong. Don't doubt yourselves. You go with the gut instinct. I think that helped a lot.
For me, I've learned that it's, like, strangely invigorating that we can get so excited over getting a question right over reading a book. I never would have figured that, ever.
Did you start out thinking that you would like it?
For me, personally, I've always loved reading. To be able to compete against how well I can remember a book was something that interests me for a year or so now.
In the beginning, I didn't even want to do Battle of the Books. I didn't even want to do it. I was just like, oh, okay, you know, let's just do it. And my teammates kind of talked me into it. I like reading, but I like reading books that I can choose to read, not books that I have to read. But in the end, everything worked out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think I had to struggle with competition?
Like a struggle? I
think there was, for me, there was points where I was like, boink, could have had a V8 moment, and I was thinking, how come I didn't get that right? Mm-hmm. I don't know how I thought it was this. Mm-hmm. But for me, I mean, I thought that the questions, though, were kind of a breeze in the beginning, but then they started to get harder, mm-hmm. and then easier, and then harder. And then we got behind, I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
And then we won. I was like, yeah!
What's the sample question?
Here, let's go. Okay, I'm going to go with the last question of the district battle, which is question number 16.
Which we ended up winning on.
It states, it states, in which book is a drug administered in a cup of tea without the character's permission? And now the answer was Caged Graves by Diane Salerni. And that is the question we ultimately won on, because three out of the four teams got the answer right, and the one team that was winning got the answer wrong.
Which put us ahead of them in the one.
By 6 points.
Now, if they would have gotten the question right, they would have beat us by literally 1 point, and mm-hmm. that would have...
Yeah.
I don't know what it
is. What was the toughest book?
The toughest book to read...
Serafina by Rachel Hartman.
It was either that or George Washington, Secret Six.
I ain't gonna lie, mine was Peak by Roland Smith. For me, I like the first time I really liked it, but then I had to read a second time, I'm like, I just can't get into it again.
We all struggled with different books. That's kind of like what the outcome was, because some books were like old school and some were like historical.
Some were sci-fi.
We had to read some Ernest Hemingway.
That was a great book. I mastered that book. That's my favorite.
Yeah, the list always includes an Alaskan author, a nonfiction, a classic. This year was Old Man in the Sea, some sci-fi or fantasy, and then something really newly published. And so the Librarians Association goes through quite the selection process to get that list of 12 books put together.
What advice do you have for other teams in the future?
Read, 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 and reread. Pretty much.
I don't know. I'd say go with your gut instinct. That seems to help a lot, but have faith. Do what you got to do. You know, there's sometimes you got to, before a battle, you got to just let your mind be free and do things that make you happy before you battle. Try to get your mind cleared.
I would advise reading the books you like the most first and then reading the ones you don't like last. Therefore, that the ones you don't like last are going to be the ones that are going to be in your head the freshest.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd probably forget if you read your favorite ones last.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, you guys have been fantastic. Congratulations for winning the award, district-wide Battle of the Books, and next week we're going to state on February 22nd. Excited about that?
Oh, of course.
We're definitely excited for that. We are definitely pretty ready, too.
I mean,
kind of scared, not going to lie. That's going to be... I don't know. I just got to keep reading.
Mm-hmm.
Got to keep reading.
Pretty much. We're going against the best of the best, and we're going to start with 25 and get weeded out to 4. So
we just got to
be.
It's going to
be difficult.
Do it.
We got to do it, though.
Definitely excited, though.
All right. Thanks for being on there with me today.
Right.
Thank you very much for having us.
This is Bird Note. From a wooded thicket along the lower Rio Grande River comes a rich, whistled song. Your eye catches a flash of brilliant orange. There's the singer, an Altamira oriole, a dashing bird. Its orange body contrasts beautifully with its black breastplate and eye patch. One of the largest orioles, at 10 inches from beak to tail, the Altamira is a tropical resident year-round, reaching into the United States only in southernmost Texas. And it was only in 1939 that the Altamira oriole was first found north of the Rio Grande. Now, it happily visits residents on the Texas side of the river, especially where juicy orange slices wait in a backyard feeder. Northerly breeding orioles, like the Bullocks in the west, and the Baltimore in the east, are migratory. These orange beauties nest as far north as Canada, but winter mostly in Central America. Their songs, too, are memorable, but no match for the music of the Altamira oriole. Sounds of the birds featured on Bird Note are provided by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I'm Mary McCann.
Weather forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with areas of rain and fog in the evening. Forecast for Wednesday, rain with high temperatures around 44 degrees.